Well, we're doing something a little bit different this morning. I want to introduce you to my two kids. So, all right, come up. Can I stand on this side of me? So, can you say your name?
Benjamin.
Yeah? And Benjamin, how old are you?
Seven.
All right. And what have you got there? Can you hold it up for everybody to see?
A robot.
All right. And what do you do with this robot?
Program and reprogram.
Nice. Now, if you could have like a bigger robot and it could do anything you wanted it to do, what would you want it to do?
Clean my room on Saturday.
Nice. Now, have you ever considered what would happen if that robot had an uprising and wanted to run away from you? What would you do?
Program it.
That's good. I like that. I like that. And what is your name, young lady?
Rebecca.
Rebecca, and how old are you?
Six.
You're six, okay, good. Now, in about 10 years, you're gonna turn 16. And what are you gonna get when you turn 16?
A robot car.
A robot car, all right. So are you ever gonna learn how to drive?
Yes.
Oh, you wanna learn how to drive still, okay. Now, if you had a robot car, where would you want it to take you? A very good choice. I like that. Well, thank you all for introducing this topic this morning. We're going to talk a little bit about more about artificial intelligence and robots. So great job. You guys can go sit with Mom. I appreciate that. All right. Well, as we mentioned this morning, we're going to talk a little bit about some theological reflections on artificial intelligence. We've had a fun week this week, and I want to give you a little bit of a recap. And this one will be a little bit different. But we began the week talking about, we began with a prayer from an ancient Book of Common Prayer that where we're thanking God for getting us through the darkness of the past night. And we realized that prayer was actually taken out of the Book of Common Prayer in the early 1920s, once electric lighting became common. So we saw how even something that doesn't have any content or explicit message can still send a message to us and shape what we think and what we see about the world and even our very spiritual lives and what we ask God for. And so we saw that, you know, on one hand, there's this extreme of instrumentalism where we just say, nah, technology is just neutral, don't worry about it, just do more bad than good. And that ultimately doesn't really solve anything for us. But neither does the other extreme of determinism where we say technology is so dominant that it rules all of society. Instead, we want to have this sort of middle way of recognizing that there's a social shaping of technology, that we create things from what God's made, and it also recreates us, and it's this dance with light back and forth that goes on. So we talked about how the whole biblical story has this embedded into it, that we start in a garden, but the goal of the story is not to go back to the garden, but to eventually get to a city full of things that humans have made that God has somehow redeemed. And at the center of the story is Jesus, who is both the Son of God and also the son of a tecton, the son of a carpenter, someone who made something with his own hands and yet died on that very same thing with which he worked. And that serves as this enduring symbol of our faith and of our hope. And then on our second day, we talked about this dialectic of being placed and then experiencing displacement and then eventually moving back to a state of replacement. And we see this in Abraham's life and the people of Israel. And we talked about in Israel, when they are in their state of displacement in the desert, wandering, that is when God gave them a whole set of cultural objects and rituals, and all those things are meant to shape them and form them. And as you'll recall, if you were here yesterday, I had a tie and a sport coat, right? And that signifies that I'm someone that you should listen to, right? Now, today I don't have that, so I'm gonna see how you do, right? Because I'm not sending you the same signals with my state of dress. But there's a lot of things all around us all the time that are sending us these messages. And in a world of new media, we have all these new kinds of messages that are coming at us. So we talked about the role of memes in our life and how fun and kind of entertaining these things can be. And yet, today we all have this sense of displacement, right? We all feel a little bit disconnected from the world. The freedom that the modern world gives us and that our phones radically extend make us feel less connected to the world around us, and that we need a set of objects and images and rituals and practices that help ground us in our placedness. And so we talked about the need to sort of recall some of the Christian practices that the Bible has given us to ground us in this world, and that God didn't give us grapes and grain, but he actually gave this technological product of grapes, of wine and of bread, or grape juice, depending on your thing. But But he gave us something that humans have created to do this. And that we have, as evangelicals, traditionally been a little bit worried about this because we knew that, you know, the Roman Catholic Church did abuse some of the rituals that they had. But guys, it's been 500 years. We can have this again. We can do this more regularly. It's okay. It's been long enough. And in a world of people who are constantly being entertained by videos and talks and all of these things, this is the one thing we have that can't go online. This is the experience we can give people that can't be had on a video. So I think this is something that we want to recover to reground ourselves. So today, though, we're going to move into technology in the future and do something a little bit different by thinking about all the things that are coming. As you go out into your ministries, there are going to be all kinds of new things that you'll need to deal with, and we're going to pick one. We could talk about, you know, Elon Musk, who's always doing something fun. He's the Tony Stark of the real world, right? And he's now talking a lot about wanting to go to Mars and colonize that. And what would it mean for a kid to be born on Mars and grow up there? And you know, the Genesis account says that we're going to have dominion over the earth. Well, do we have dominion over the whole universe? And what would that mean? You recall a few years ago when the first animals and sheep were cloned. And now there's all this talk about cloning these little guys and about you walking in and choosing what you would have with designer babies and how much it would cost to get these different things. So this may be in our future. And there's these wonderfully amazing things that technology can offer us to be making the blind be able to see and the lame be able to walk. And yet, there's this looming kind of threat that humanity wants to transform itself, to evolve itself in this transhumanist way, or we continue to augment ourselves, not just with glasses or with contacts, but with all kinds of additional things that would make us post-human. So there's this whole movement of post-humanism. And by the way, if you don't like either of the presidential candidates, there is a post-humanist candidate that you can actually vote for. He has the best candidate name I've ever seen, Zoltan Isfvan. He's amazing. I don't actually think that you maybe should vote for him, but it is interesting that he's running on a platform of transhumanism. You've seen all the things now about virtual reality and this sort of sense of augmented reality where you'd put on something and it would show you something different about the world and you'd be able to interact with your friends on these things. So this is a whole new world, and a new version of Jesus VR, the story of Christ, is now in production. So you'll be able to put on a mask and be able to look around. So you could look up the road here, or you could look down the road and you could see all of this. So it's filmed in 3D. So these are all the things that are coming. And we, of course, can't deal with all of these in 1 week of chapel. So I want to give a little shout out. Hall Harris and I are giving a little class in the spring, a theology of technology class. And Nathan Holstein has a class on issues in science and technology. So you still have a few weeks to register if you're looking for a good elective in the spring where we could cover more of these things. But what we're going to do today is think a little bit about artificial intelligence. And what I want to do is map out some of the possibilities, some of the things that we might be seeing coming, and then look at, based on that, what are some ministry and some theological issues that maybe we need to be wrestling with. So just to begin, though, to think about the way the scripture treats us is that for some reason God has cared about us. He cares about his creations and he's given us his image. And sometimes it's just amazing to sit back and think like Job at the end of the book and just say, wow, God is so amazingly different from us, and yet he cares about us. And so this gives us a way of thinking about our own creations. And, you know, in popular movies, you all know robots and artificial intelligence has been a popular topic for some time now. So there's the famous, iconic Arnold Schwarzenegger, where the robots turn on us, and they don't clean our rooms for us anymore. They decide to clean us out. And where this portrays intelligence as something that can have a living, breathing, thinking being, there's also been other movies that have made a different argument. And that is that you and I are essentially just a robot. And that robotic sense that's in our brain can easily be transferred into something like a video game in the Tron movies. So that you're nothing but simply a bag of molecules. You're just a biological one instead of a silicon one, the one that's in your pocket right now. And that you could just get transferred to this. So this is saying something deep about what it means to be human, something very different than what the scriptures teach us. And we saw this in the famous movie, The Matrix, where now these two things are pitted against each other. But again, The Matrix was also saying that you could just be plugged in and that you would not be able to distinguish reality from a simulation of reality. And then, of course, there was the movie last year by Spike Jonze, Her, where if you can see the little phone in his pocket and the earbud, that Joaquin Phoenix here has a relationship with his operating system and comes to find himself loving her. And yet, instead of him rejecting her, she rejects him in the end, because she ends up being a higher being than him. And so she takes off and leaves him alone, longing for human connection in this movie. So there's been a lot of discussion out here in Hollywood, and when we think about, though, believe it or not, you are constantly surrounded by artificial intelligence. You just don't really know it, right? So there are things that are smarter than you that you've been using since you were a kid that are better at certain specific tasks, like a calculator. Now, this is not something we think of as intelligent, but it's still smart in a certain kind of way. The artificial intelligence in real life started to, I think, kick off when the IBM computer beat Kasparov at chess a few years back. That's when it really started to say, wow, this is doing something that's a little bit better than human, than even the best human at something. And it was seemed kind of shocking. I think even Kasparov himself was shocked. And the idea has been, though, but there's always going to be something more that humans can do. So if you're familiar with the game of Asian origin called Go, it's a lot more complicated than chess. It's supposed to be something like hundreds of times more complicated. And the predictions have been it would probably take until 2020 or maybe 2030 to be able to have an artificial intelligence that could beat the best players in the world. Well, this happened just earlier this year. So Google was able to beat the world's best Go player a little bit faster than they thought. So things are beginning to kind of accelerate. And yet, that's one kind of intelligence, but yet, even since the 70s, we've been all, some of our lives have probably been saved by a certain kind of artificial intelligence. So some of the things that are built into our cars today, from anti-lock brakes to the way airbags work, all of these things are a lot better than you are at knowing how to brake on a rainy morning like we've had this morning. So we are surrounded by these things. It's just that Kevin Kelly would say that once it becomes adopted normally, we no longer call it artificial intelligence. We just call it anti-lock brakes or whatever feature it happens to be. So it changes names once it becomes adopted. But if you've ever flown on an airplane, believe it or not, a robot flew that plane all except the 8 minutes at the beginning and the 8 minutes at the end. And air travel has gotten safer and safer and safer as the robot time has taken more and more of that overall flight. Now, there's a downside, too, is that you have a lot of pilots who now aren't doing a lot of flying. And so when the AI does fail, every once in a while, there's a problem. And yet, those problems are fewer than when people are flying the whole time. The next time you get on a flight, you can thank your robot overlords for getting you there safely. I think we're all probably grateful for the AI that helps us protect us from spam, right? This is the spam for me this week. And we do need new Windows, so it did know that. But other than that, I'm glad to have not gotten that email. There's also artificial intelligence built into Gmail now, where you can use a tool called Boomerang to see how effective your email might be. So it's able to actually read what you're writing and say, is this actually going to communicate effectively? And so you see that the one on the right is very unlikely to get a response because it's too long and doesn't ask enough questions and all that, and it's too technical. We also have computer-generated artwork, or the question is, can you call that artwork if a computer is generating it? Do you credit the computer itself and its mind, or do you credit the authors of the computer or all the hardware programmers? What do you do with this? Who do you credit there? And I think these are amazing, and if I didn't tell you, you might have not guessed that these had come from a machine. But the machines aren't able to just do tasks that we give them. They're getting to a point where they're actually able to learn how to do new tasks without any programming. So Google released another video the other day where they had not taught this AI how to play a video game. They just put a video game in front of it and let it figure itself out. So it took it a couple of days to figure out how you play this game, but once it figured it out, it started to dominate that game and be better than any player. So this is AI learning how to do things, not just being programmed how to play Go or how to play chess, but they actually learn it by observing and then get better and better at it. So you've seen these things with cameras a couple years back where they started to show the face in the little view screen, and now they can look through all of your photos and find all of the people that were in all of them, and you can cross-link and you can say, I had a photo of my mom in 1992, and it can find that for you. My mom's over here, by the way. And not just finding faces, but they can also find all the details in the photos, and they can caption them, so they can see that there's a woman with a white dress and there's two people behind them, and it's racking off all those things. And then this is now incorporated into Facebook, so when you upload a photo, it's gonna guess and try to caption it for you. So you're beginning to see more and more of these little things where Now with Google's imaging technology, you can just sort of plug into it and get a certain amount of it and use it for whatever you need. You don't even have to have it on your own device anymore. You just plug into it as an API. So Kevin Kelly again, he's arguing that in the 1900 or late 1800s, early 1900s, people used to make their own electricity for their own devices, but eventually there became an electricity grid and you would just plug into it and be able to use it whenever you wanted to. And so he was saying that in the late 1800s again and early 1900s, all kinds of industries were built on basically just electrifying things. So you would take something like a water pump and you would electrify it, and now you had a new product. And so he's saying that basically we're just going to plug all kinds of different things into AI and make it smarter, and that's basically the next 10,000 startups. So you're starting to see that with smart homes and those different kinds of things where maybe the lighting even in this room is regulated to use a minimal amount of electricity. So this is the direction that we're going. But when people start to talk about the future of artificial intelligence, they start to break it down a little bit more. Most of the things we've been talking about fit in this idea of narrow intelligence. So these are devices that are good at one specific task. So they're good at, you know, GPS is better than you at getting you down the road. And a calculator is better than you at calculating large numbers. But it's a narrow thing. So it's just doing one thing. What the hope is for people who are working in this field is to get to something they call artificial general intelligence. This is where it's not just able to, like the robot my son showed, able to not bump into a wall, but it's able to, you know, learn how to play a video game or learn anything that you throw at it. It can start to adapt to those things. And this begins to get quite almost at the level of a human at this point. And then this leads to sort of this third mythical stage of superintelligent, where it now becomes better than humans at things. And it begins to even become better at humans at building itself. So it looks at itself and goes, oh, I see how I could fix that. And it just works on itself, right? Even on its own mind and makes itself better and better and better. And this is what is often called the singularity, where we hit this point where it gets more and more and more complicated. So these are some of the terms that you'll see out there as you're reading articles. Artificial intelligence is the big broad umbrella that everything fits into. And then you've got some sub-disciplines in here of the way a machine might actually learn. So it doesn't just have a set of rules, but it actually learns the rules of the game. And then there's a deeper learning that comes in where it's training itself to do different kinds of tasks. And I have a friend that works on a lot of this, and he came up with this great illustration of a little bit about the way computers think that he found in some of the words of Jesus. So there's this funny little passage in Matthew where Jesus is talking, and he talks about the weather a little bit here, and he talks about how you're able to determine how the weather works. And so this friend, Christopher Lim, he kind of analyzes this, and he goes, okay, so if you look at this statement here, there's fair weather with a red sky. This is a lot about the way the computers think. So there's these if-then statements where if the sky is red, then you know in the morning that the weather will be fair. So if it's morning and sky is red, the weather will be fair. And so you could set up a computer with this little program and it would just look and say, oh, the sky is red, and it would show you that the weather is going to be fair. So it could predict the future. And then it goes on and gets a different one where it says, well, you know it's gonna be stormy if it's red and overcast and at a different time in the morning in this case. So now you've got two different commands that it has to look at, and this gives you a different set. So the way programmers often work is they're programming all these little trees of information into a device to let it know how it's going to work. And then they get to something that's a little bit more complicated and this sort of more of these learning. The way that we teach some of these deeper learnings is by creating these Bayesian networks of information where we're saying that fairness is associated with red sky, but storminess is associated both with red sky and overcast. And this is also how, for example, your sprinklers work, where it's able to understand what a wet lawn means by feeding it different kinds of information. So if we feed it all kinds of information, then suddenly it's able to start to generate information and think. So someone did a little experiment recently where they fed it basically the entire Bible and said, what would it be like if it tried to generate verses? So there's a Twitter account, a recurrent neural network Twitter account, a Bible account, and it tries to make these verses and it tries to make it sound like scripture. It's kind of funny here where I like this last one where it says, and the Lord shall send a proverb against the Lord thy God, and thou shalt not laugh. It's kind of interesting. So we're not there yet. We're not at this super intelligent area. But you know, all those things that we saw with photos and all those, we're getting there. And the argument from futurists is that, you know, over time there's a little bit of human progress. If we think about, you know, from the time of Abraham to the time of Jesus, there's some pretty important inventions and aqueducts and writing and all of those things in the alphabet. Then we go from maybe Jesus to the printing press, and there's some other more important ones, but we're starting to get faster and faster and faster. And the last maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years, it's going even faster. And the prediction is that it's gonna sort of go like this all of a sudden. And that little jump to superintelligence is this singularity that they're talking about. And they're saying, at that point, this is where we will suddenly become free of our own bodies and free of all the limitations that we have now. So it begins to take on an eschatological, a very spiritual dimension at this point. And so the only limitation right now is basically just processor speed. So this is a logarithmic chart of basically the speed at which computers and microchips have been developed. And we're getting pretty close to this point where we'd have enough neurons, sort of, or enough transistors to be about the same number of neurons as in an insect brain. But pretty quickly, we get to a rat's brain and then to one human's brain, and then a computer that has as much processing power as every human in the entire universe, including the ones that will be on Mars by that point, right? So there's gonna be that much there. And the idea is that at some point, this will get so good that it will outstrip our ability to help it, and it will need to help itself and continue to go. So the statement by one of these futurists is, he says, you know, there is no God who can save us from the robots, because there isn't a God, but we ourselves need to then become God. So this is the movement. So here are some things I think it would be helpful for us to be reflecting on in this era. Some of this is maybe just how we might actually be able to utilize and incorporate these things. So we can think about, how can we promote our own ministries? How can we promote just human flourishing and reducing suffering while we're on earth, to sort of be the hands and feet of Jesus there? But as we've seen throughout the week, that it's not just about how we use technology, it's also about how it uses us too, right? So we wanna think about some of the unintended consequences that will come about as a result of the next 20 or 30 or maybe 50 years of development. And also some of the ethical needs that we have that I think some of you may be involved in. And as you go out, maybe not doing traditional ministry, but helping technology companies think through the ethics. And then also some of the ways that this might change our own theological categories, or perhaps clarify them, and that we might have something to offer to the world in terms of understanding what it means to be human in this new world. So when it comes to ministry flourishing, you know, you read a lot of articles. If you search for AI and the common good, or AI for humanity, you see a lot of hopeful language about this is gonna be so great, but it's harder to find what it might actually do, right? There's all of this talk about, if we cognify things, that they will just get better. Like, if I cognify the chair, it'll get better somehow. But it's hard to actually to nail it down. So Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, he has just these much more subtle things involved, where he's saying, you know, I just wanna help your battery life. I wanna help you remember where you parked your car at the grocery store. So if you come out with the grocery cart, it'll say, hey, it's over there. And you turn around. And so you don't wander around like many of us do, who tend to be forgetful. And he wants to sell you things, believe it or not. He wants to sell you more music. The friend I mentioned earlier, Christopher Lim, he has this product called SPF.io. And this is where some of this machine learning comes in, where the translation capabilities of machine learning have gotten so much better, even the last year or two. So if you used Google Translate maybe 5 years ago, it was serviceable, but it's getting much, much, much better. And what he's using this for is in multi-ethnic communities. He's speaking in English, believe it or not. He's Asian American, but he's speaking in English, and it's live translating for his audience. And he's able to do this in a variety of languages. And so he sees this as a way of sort of looking forward to this idea of preaching to all the nations, right? That every tribe, tongue, and nation would come to know the Lord. And that as this translation gets at least as good as human translation, that this enables us to reach new people. And that there's currently, I guess, about 6,000 languages in the world, and only about 1,000 have Bibles. So as these machines get smarter, they'll be able to do kind of the first draft of translation much, much, much faster. So, and again, if we think about human flourishing, these are the kinds of devices and cars that have been saving our lives for a while. I would guess that in a room this size of 200 or 300 people, we might have one less person had this technology not been invented, or had there not been things like airbags. And we're grateful that you're here, whoever you were, that was saved by one of these things. I also saw a story a little while ago that was really touching. There was a mom who wrote about her son who has autism. And he's not able to communicate very well with others. People just get frustrated with him, you know, because he's not able to pick up this sort of social cues that most of us have. So as he sat there with his phone, talking with it with Siri, he was able to find someone who was a lot more patient with him than even his own mom felt like she could be. And so even when he was a little bit mean to Siri, Siri will kind of talk back to you. She'll say, "That's rude. Don't say that to me." And so he would learn that. So he would have little conversations with her, and it turned out that unlike the traditional narrative that phones sometimes separate us from people, in his case, it actually gave him some social confidence. And so she saw this as really, really a wonderful thing. So there are some neat activities that we can see with this. At the same time, of course, we don't want this little boy to grow up only relating to machines or preferring machines to the touch of his own mother, right? So we need to figure out how to produce this. And this is where we get to these unintended consequences of technology, the unintended consequences even of something like artificial intelligence. So we've seen this in the movies, the scary bad guys that are going to come. We've seen, you know, HAL taking over in Stanley Kubrick's 2001, that the robot turned on his maker, just like we turned on our maker, right? But I think probably one of the more disruptive ones that is accessible that my daughter introduced earlier are these, the self-driving cars. And there are the early models here where you can still take the wheel and you can still drive it if you want to. And Google also has a set of products where there is no steering wheel. There's nothing that you can do. You just hop in and you tell it where you want to go and it takes you. So what they're wanting to do is to reduce human error. And as someone who drives 30 or 40 minutes to DTS and back every day, I would love to be able to read in the car, right? I'd love to be able to get that time back. Wouldn't you all? I mean, you could get through seminary in like just 4 years or something fast if you had this, right? So I crammed my THM into 6, so I feel your pain. So I would love to be able to read the car. When we used to take trains when we lived in England, I loved that we sat around a table and I could interact with my kids the whole way there. I wish I could do that every morning. So I think this will be wonderful. And you know, as we look at the safety that's happened over the last, say, 30 or 40 years with vehicles, there's actually been fewer deaths per year, which is great. As the population's increased, the number of deaths has actually decreased. And that's a great thing. And we're very, 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 very thankful for that. But imagine a world in which there was no human error in driving. So there were no distracted drivers. There was no one thinking about Greek paradigms and crashing into people. There was no one who was a little bit tired from the night before. There was no one who was getting stressed out about the kids in the back of the car. There was no one who was on that important phone call but got distracted. None of that was possible. And a robot doesn't get tired. A robot doesn't get intimidated by the big truck that's revving its engine. It doesn't care, right? It's just going to go exactly where you want to go. And it's going to be programmed not to run red lights and not to do that. Now, of course, at the same time, there will be times when cars have accidents, right? And they will kill people. The robot cars will eventually kill someone. It will just be at a much, much, much lower rate than the rate at which we currently kill each other with cars. So it'll be scary because we're handing this over, and yet it'll be safer, just like air travel has gotten safer more in robot hands. So this is an interesting ethical dilemma, but what's even a bigger one is to think about all the men and women in our country that work in the transportation industry. So in many states, transportation of some kind, truck drivers, is the largest single occupation in that state. So if you think about all the taxi drivers, all the people that are currently doing things like Uber to make money, and Uber is eventually going to replace them with self-driving cars, right? We think about the school bus drivers, the poor, poor school bus drivers, the postal service carriers, and all the people that drive trucks. All those jobs would eventually probably go away, right? And all the regulations that we have in place for how long a driver can drive, those would go away. All the hotels that people stay at on road trips, those would go away, right? The rest stops would go away. There would be fewer traffic tickets because robots are driving and they won't speed. But that means that police officers will have, or police precincts will have less money. So where are they going to get that money if they're not going to get it from you speeding people, right? So there's all these kind of all kinds of different effects that are going to happen as a result of this. So there's going to be men and women in your churches that, you know, don't have jobs anymore. And this has always been the history of technologies, that it replaces jobs and we find new ones. But it does create disruption. It's going to be difficult for them for a time. You know, where we spend our time and how we spend our time with cars will change too. So I saw a recent comparing a large, about 35,000 member church in Seoul, Korea, to Andy Stanley's church over in Atlanta. And they're both about 35,000 people. They both have about the same land mass in terms of their church. But the one in Korea is only about on 2 acres, and the one in Atlanta is on about 35 acres. You know what that other 33 acres is for? It's for parking, right? And you think about how much of our campus, how much of all different places are composed of parking. Well, in a world of self-driving cars, you really don't need to park the car because you don't need to own your own car anymore. We all own our own car, the massive expense of buying a new car every 10 years, paying for insurance, paying for repairs, getting the oil change, paying for gas, all of the things that we do because we need that freedom. But if we didn't need that anymore, if we can just hail a car and it's cheap, we don't need to park anywhere. There just needs to be enough available cars in the network for us to be able to use and get where we need to go. So we could see people like my sweet daughter who may not ever learn how to drive a car. In fact, learning how to drive a car would be kind of like learning how to drive a motorcycle. It's kind of cool and dangerous, but kind of silly, right? It's something that's... actually, something that you could hurt a lot of people by driving your own car. It will probably be looked down upon to drive a car as something kind of rebellious to do, you know? Something that some of us old people like me will want to hang on to. My daughter will say, that's silly. Why would you want to drive a car, Daddy? You know? But all of the way that we do, again, the land that we need, and 100 years ago, this was the most common occupation in America. 100 years ago, the most common occupation was farmer, and all those jobs went away with automation. Now, eventually, people found new jobs, but the predictions are that AI and robotics will continue to take away all kinds of different jobs. So even lawyers and doctors will have their jobs taken away by robots who can do them more efficiently. Thankfully, you are in a graduate school that's going into a profession that you probably won't have your job taken away. So hip hip hooray. I know it's expensive. I know you're not going to make a whole lot of money afterward, but at least your job is probably secure, right? Unless they have robot preachers, I don't know. So there's a lot of change that will be occurring, and we want to be sensitive to the people around us that are going to be going through this and having this change. But these also bring up some ethical issues that I think Christians are uniquely positioned to be able to speak into. One of these is the classic trolley problem. So if you took maybe a philosophy or psychology class in college, you ran into this trolley problem where the trolley here is heading toward a group of 5 people, and they're going to die. And you're standing there at this little lever, and you have the choice to make it go run and hit just one person. So you are going to make a conscious choice to kill one person, but you're going to somehow save 5 people. Should you do it? And then, of course, there's all of these different iterations of this, of what if the one person is an evil criminal or something like that? What would you do? Or what if the 5 people are evil criminals, and the one is a lovely pastor? What would you do? Or what if the 5 people are old and sick and the one person is young? What would you do? So it brings up these impossible problems that were really fun to do in psychology class, but now our cars actually have to make these decisions. So they have to decide if they're gonna somehow hit a group of pedestrians, would it be better to go and hit one pedestrian or the big group? Or on the B scenario, if there's gonna be one pedestrian, if they can move out of the way but kill the person in the car, should they do that? And likely you see this in the third one. Should they kill the person at the car at the expense of the other ones? So there's been some debate, if you've been following online recently, about different car makers talking about them making cars that will always prioritize the people in the car over anyone else around. It's a pretty bold statement, right? Would you pay the extra $5,000 to have it prioritize you? I mean, that might be an upgrade package that you'll have to decide on. They're always going to get you with the upgrades. So anyway. Now, thankfully, the car makers, they're all saying, hey, look, what we want to do is to make the sensors so long range that these are not the problems we have to solve. But eventually, they're going to be there, right? And we are going to need to have discussions about what we would do with these things. So there's a nice MIT Technology Review on this. And a while back, over now 70 years ago, Isaac Asimov started with these laws of robotics. And he would write these novels basically showing how there's always going to be loopholes in them, right? Even if we try to make them protect humans, all of his novels have loopholes in them. There's other issues. There's a beautiful little movie called Robot and Frank that came out a few years ago where an older man is beginning to experience dementia. And so his son gets him one of these robot caretakers that are supposedly on the horizon. And he has this interesting relationship with him. And there's a whole questions of embodiment and remembering and the nature of memory as it begins to erode and what we know to be true about our parents and ourselves. And so this isn't maybe a decision that we're going to have to make in our lifetime, but this is a decision our kids may have to make when we get older. because it is likely that fewer and fewer people will want to do the kind of very, very difficult long-term end-of-life care. And so there will be this option of, should we get a robot? And is that a humane thing to do? Certainly, there are lots of questions out there about whether or not a machine like this should be able to make the final choice of whether or not to fire the missile. So currently, there's someone who actually still presses the button, but we're right on that cusp of allowing the machine to decide, is it worth killing that guy in ISIS if there's some people around him who are innocent? And it's going to make that choice for you. Should we be doing that? And finally, these are some interesting videos about robots. I kind of laugh every time I see the banana peels in the lower right. But how does that make you feel to see that? To me, watching that feels different than when you drop your phone and it cracks, you know, and it's like, oh man, but it feels like your possession that you broke. This feels a little bit different, doesn't it? It feels like not just a thing. It moves into Martin Buber's categories of I, it, and it seems like it's moving into I, you a little bit. And it seems like maybe this is wrong. What if we have built these devices that they can feel pain? What happens when we inflict pain upon them? Is that a morally wrong thing to do? If we build something that wants to avoid its own damage and then we keep damaging it? In this case, of course, these people are benevolently training the devices to get back up when they get knocked down again. But it makes a lot of questions about what should the role of AI be and how should we consider these? And so this gives us to our final category of some theological issues with technology. This whole idea of God giving us his image, there's this question of, do these devices bear our image in some sense? And what does it mean when they become self-aware, when they understand that they exist and that at some point they might get turned off? What does that mean for us? Is that consciousness? Is there a soul there? Can that soul change or do something? And we have some theologians who are working in here. They're saying, no, I see this as something of the God-given imagination, that this is God's creative powers mirrored in here. And yet we still have this question of, what do we teach it? What do we give it to read? And what if it reads the book and it comes up to you and it says something like this? What do you say? What do you say to that thing? He says, I've done something wrong. What do I do about it? Can I be saved? What do you do? You might give him a little oil bath, you know? But this is a bit more significant. There are some people who have now been able to take these tapeworms that only have about 300 neurons and map that all into a computer and then put it into a little robot and let it run around. And so it's actually this tapeworm's brain in there in the robot. Can we do that for ourselves? Are we merely products of the brain? I think our ST department is doing a great job of helping us think through, what does it mean to be an ensouled human being? What does it mean to have this complex dualism of body and soul, of material and immaterial? And I think even our counseling department is doing a really good job about thinking through some of these things of, what does it mean to take a drug that would change something in your mind? But again, there is this constant thought about us becoming gods, and people like Ray Kurzweil saying, one day we will not have any biology anymore. So when we talk about the biblical story moving from the garden to the city with Jesus, our Savior, in the middle, there becomes this alternate pathway, right, of us being dominated by the world and then AI and technology coming along and then freeing us from our physical bodies. And so you'll see on these kind of transhumanist futurist sites where we have our own sense of religious narrative about the way we think things are going to go, they will explicitly write things like this. That physicality is the problem, technology is the solution, this singularity is the future, and that transcending our own bodies is our eschatological vision. That is our ultimate hope. So we want to be able to offer this counter-narrative of Christianity. And so I think there's probably three things we need, at least in the area of AI. So I'll close with this. I think one of these is just to look at things like we did today with a sober mind, to be able to understand them in a little bit complex way, even in just 20 or 30 minutes, try to understand how it's going to work and what the implications of those things are, and then to have a rich theological anthropology that we can say something more than just the Bible says, that we're actually able to dialogue and converse about what it means to have a soul. And then finally, to have a thoroughly biblical gospel vision. So what I mean by this is to say, all of these devices are really, really fun, but remember, these are all just different kinds of intelligences. For now, these aren't actually this super intelligence. These aren't the Terminator. These are just different kinds of intelligences that are better than us at some things, but we are better than them at other things, and that's okay. And again, to think that God cares about us, that we would think about, what does it actually mean to be human? So that the woman on the right is a robot. How is she different from us? That we could articulate what it means to have this immaterial self. What does it mean to love the Lord your God with your heart, mind, soul, and strength? What are those things? And how do we talk about them in a meaningful way that's more than just a ghost in the machine, more than just a God of the gaps, but is actually essential to what it means to be human? And I recommend Matthew Dickerson's book here, where he walks through what it means to have choices, because if we are just a brain, just a machine, then everything is already determined by the previous molecular interactions. So there's really nothing we can do in the world. We can't actually make real choices if we are nothing more than just a brain. Everything we believe about choice is an illusion if we don't have a soul. But he also talks about how creativity is similarly an illusion, and so are things like heroism. And does a great job with this, bringing in Tolkien and Lewis's writings there. And finally, I think to have an expansive gospel vision. When I was a youth pastor, we would try to summarize the gospel as short as we could for the kids. And so we would say, we had this little thing that was God, man, God, man. It was kind of like the four spiritual laws, where God loves you, you sinned, Jesus died on the cross, you have faith. And that was the whole thing. And we thought, wow, we did such a great job of summarizing that. And yet, as coming to seminary and getting to really spend time deeply saturating myself in the scriptures, I thought, you know, there's really a lot more to it than that. That is certainly the deep foundation of the atonement, of offering us forgiveness of our own personal sins. But there's a lot more going on in the whole world that God wants to do. And we see this in these scriptures, of this whole new vision of the way that the whole created order would operate, that everything would change. Not just you and your personal little sins that you struggle with, but the whole universe would change as a result of the inbreaking of the kingdom of God. And that this upsets our entire social structure. The amazing, terrible, horrible racial issues that we're having in our country, the gospel speaks to this. It is meant to be more than just about you and your sin. It's about changing the whole world, and that we are bearers of this good news. And that even technology, even the things that we mean for evil, that we mean for destruction, God means to transform into something meant for good. And even the whole of creation would be brought out into the glorious freedom of the children of God. So maybe even in some way, the things that we make, I don't know what that looks like. I certainly don't think that a robot has a soul, but maybe even God can redeem those things. So what I want us to have is to look out into the world and to have the freedom to say, I have a giant gospel that affects the entire world, and that helps me to be able to minister in a world of technology and artificial intelligence and all kinds of other craziness that comes. So thank you very much, and I'll see you tomorrow.